From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Illinois leaders have touted the state as ready for the green energy revolution. We have some big climate goals, but are they realistic and want us to happen to make it all work? We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week, making his first appearance on the show, Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco. He's a climate change reporter with WBEZ and GRIST, a national climate magazine. Juan Pablo, it's great to have you on with us.
Happy to be here, Sean.
So Illinois passed a landmark law back in 2021. It was known as the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, also called CEJA for short. And it basically requires Illinois to use 100% clean energy by the year 2050. Now, I'm going to ask you, Juan Pablo, you know, are we, I know we're just right out of the gates with this law when it comes right down to just a couple of years, but are we on pace to meet that goal? What still has to happen? I guess, how realistic is it?
Sean, the way you put that is kind of funny that we're right out of the gate with it. But what's interesting with Illinois and what makes Illinois kind of unique among almost every other state in the country is that it's got a giant advantage. Illinois produces more nuclear energy than any other state in the country. And so in practical matters, what that means is that more than 50% of Illinois' energy mix is nuclear energy, so carbon-free energy. So we have this huge head start. So what we really have to do at this point is just knock off that other 50%. So really, at this point, it's our ball to kind of fumble. We have 6 nuclear power plants in northern Illinois and 11 different reactors. Again, that's more than any other state in the country. And that produces something like 50 to 53% of our energy, a huge amount of all of that is to say that Illinois already has a huge chunk of its energy that's coming from carbon-free energy.
Charlie, when we go back on this law, when it was passed, and it is landmark legislation, a lot of people tout it, but there are a lot of people who were concerned about it. Maybe Illinois, I hate to use the term, putting the cart before the horse, that's going back when it comes to energy, but at the same time, that seemed to be in many people's minds, maybe we are putting ourselves out there a lot more than, say, other states nearby are doing and could be setting ourselves up for some financial problems down the road. Did you see it that way?
No, I think, as Juan Pablo said, we have an advantage in that we have a huge nuclear industry. And as a matter of fact, we've had it for so long, if I'm not mistaken, it would have been, maybe 50 years ago when the first reactor started at Dresden. As a matter of fact, we've had a couple that have outlived their operating life and are now sitting dormant. And one of the problems that's not been resolved, and I don't see any solution on the horizon, is what to do with the spent nuclear waste. In the nuclear power plant, the fissionable materials produce enough heat to basically boil the water to turn the turbines, but they lose their potency. The radioactive materials decay, and they're not able to do the job of producing electricity, but they're still highly radioactive, and some of them will be for like 20,000 years. And so what do you do with them? We've got pools. There's one up in Zion that has these spent nuclear fuel rods, highly radioactive, sitting under 20 feet of water. And this has been an issue for, almost since nuclear industry got started. What do we do with these spent fuel rods? And there's no answer yet. It's got to come from the federal government. So that's one of the big issues, but that's not the same type of, threat, if you will, that continuing to burn coal, natural gas, and putting carbon dioxide, putting methane into the atmosphere poses in terms of climate change. One of the things that is interesting, you asked, Sean, you asked, how are we doing? Well, one of the provisions of the law that the governor signed back in 2021 requires the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, the Commerce Commission, and the Illinois Power Agency to jointly conduct a study every 5 years on the state's progress toward its renewable energy resources development goals and the current and projected status of electric resource adequacy and reliability throughout the state. Now, this five-year study is supposed to start in 2025, in other words, next year, and that would give us a better idea of how we're doing. My sense is that in some areas, we're probably not doing as well as we would like. One of the goals, for example, was to have at least 1 million electric vehicles in Illinois by 2030. Well, that's only 6 years away. And according to the latest estimates or the latest information from the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, which keeps track of the rebates of up to $4,000 consumers who purchase electric vehicles are eligible for, they've only given out about 8,000 rebates for these electric vehicles. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's only 8,000 EV cars and trucks on the road, but my guess is most people, if you were to buy an electric vehicle, you would go ahead and go for the rebate. So it seems to me that if there's only 8,000 rebates out there, and in 6 years we want to have 1 million vehicles, we're maybe lagging behind on that. Part of the difficulty is, of course, is the charging stations. We don't have a built-in network yet, so that if you do buy an electric vehicle, that you can be guaranteed to get from here to there before the battery runs out.
Yeah, and I want to mention or touch on that for just a minute, because I think about, me personally, like, I'm not going to be able to say, well, let's get rid of the nuclear plants or let's stop doing this or that. Those are much bigger decisions. But one area the average consumer can help with is the type of vehicle they drive, for example. Yet we're kind of hearing, Juan Pablo, that there seems to be a pullback on electric vehicle manufacturing and more into hybrids. Does that seem to be what's going on here? And is that going to be a problem for the state of Illinois going forward to meet these goals?
You know, when I think about EVs, I think a lot in line of what Charlie's saying, which is that the EV infrastructure, it's kind of like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg, right? Like, do you really want an EV if you're not sure if you can make it from Chicago to Rockford? Well, one of the things that's happening right now is that, one, the state is putting a ton of money into expanding this infrastructure, and two, it just got a bunch of federal money to even supercharge that sum. And that was through something called the Climate Pollution Reduction Grant. It got something like $115 million to make this like a reality. So when people are confronted with that choice, which is like, do I want an EV? Then they can think, yeah, it's actually more feasible than I thought.
And one of the things is there's kind of a trend, and I'm not a car aficionado, so I'm not really into this, but you read and you hear and you see it on the road, people really like to get humongous, huge pickup trucks, for example, or they like these big SUVs. Part of the thinking behind going to the electric vehicles is you'd get a smaller car and you wouldn't need such a huge one. But at least around Springfield, I see an awful lot of monster pickup trucks. And you think to yourself, how would that ever be able to be converted to an electric vehicle? I mean, not that particular vehicle, but if someone likes that size of the vehicle, is it practical for them to get an electric vehicle at this point?
Illinois is also trying to cater to the industries, and vehicles are a classic example of this. We have the Rivian plant in Normal. We've had other changes, other battery plants being talked about in the state of Illinois. So Governor J.B. Pritzker, he is all in on this idea, and he wants to make Illinois sort of the spot for not just going green in the sense of how we produce our energy, but also in jobs and manufacturing. Is that safe to say?
Well, as a matter of fact, Governor Pritzker, when he signed this legislation, and it would have been in September of 2021, so that would have been 3 years ago, one of the things he said, and I'm quoting from his news release, "We can't outrun or hide from climate change, not to the north where the boundary waters burn, not to the south where Ida swallows lives and livelihoods in the blink of an eye." And he's referring to a couple of disasters that occurred that summer. There is no time to lose. Thanks to the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, Illinois is taking action in the fight to stop and even reverse the damage that's been done to our climate. As of today, Illinois is a force for good, for an environmental future we can be proud of. With economic growth and jobs woven into its fabric, this new law is the most significant step Illinois has taken in a generation toward a reliable, renewable, affordable, and clean energy future in a generation. So yeah, he's 100% behind this, and he sees it as, I would say, a very important part of his future legacy.
Yeah, he's all in on this, right, Juan Pablo?
Yeah, I would say that Governor Pritzker is all in on this, because even when we think about the Clean Energy Jobs Act, I mean, it's in the name, right? Jobs. And going back to even the way we think about EVs, like what comes first, the EV or the charging station? In this case, when we think about what comes first, the jobs or the industry where they're going to work in, Governor Pritzker, a big part of the Clean Jobs Energy Act is putting these kind of workforce development programs in business. So CEJA invests something like $82 million a year in workforce development. And that's to make sure that contractors, workers are ready and prepared to work in these kind of green industries.
Well, you mentioned some of the money that the federal government has been providing for infrastructure, for different projects and such. It seems to me that clean energy is going to happen, but it's also going to be, at least in the beginning, pretty highly subsidized. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, absolutely, certainly. You know, part of the reason, part of the thinking here is that, you know, we're trying to replace fossil fuels. What do fossil fuels do? They put carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere that heats up the planet, that makes things inhospitable for us down here. And so to kind of move the needle and make it likely or favorable for other technologies to emerge, what the government's doing here is it's kind of tipping the scales. And they're saying, we are going to help push these kind of technologies forward. And the idea being that we provide cleaner energy, and in the long run, we reduce the kind of severe climate impacts that could happen if we just continued on with fossil fuels. And that's kind of the idea or the impetus behind why would the government would want to incentivize it.
Charlie, I told people before, I grew up in Southern Illinois. There was, of course, a pretty big coal industry still going when I was young, but that soon faded, say, by the time I got into high school, and we know what's happened with that since. It's hard to bring industry to the area, at least in the at the level that you'd really like to see, that could really boost the region and its jobs picture. But I look at something like this, this new technology, and think to myself, and I would say the same about West Virginia and some of the other locations that have relied on coal. These are the perfect spots to really build up this type of new technology.
The difficulty is attracting, it's kind of a chicken and the egg. Do you have the skilled workforce to attract the company, or does the company come there and then they train the skilled workforce? And part of the law that was signed provides for, as Juan Pablo said, training, and encourages taking workers who, or young people who maybe back in the day would have gone to work in the mines, to prepare them for these kind of jobs working in clean industries. One of the things I found interesting is, and I'm not sure if we're participating or not, but there's a program to take abandoned coal mines and use them, or abandon coal-fired power plants and use those as a area or facilities in which you can put the kind of storage batteries that you would need to be able to use, for example, wind power or solar power, and bank it for times when the wind's not blowing or the sun's not shining. And I don't know if we've done any in Illinois, if we're doing any here in Illinois, but there have been ones, and there's been talk of it, of, say, this coal-fired power plant is shut down. We've got the grounds here. We've got the facilities. It's not really good for anything else. Well, how about if we put these humongous batteries? And I mean, I've seen pictures of the structures, and they're, if you've ever seen pictures of a ocean-going cargo vessel with all the semi-trailer cargo packets packed on top of it. That's what they look like. They've got these huge containers, and they stack them up and they fill them with high-tech batteries that store the electricity for when it's needed. So that's something that will maybe provide jobs in areas that have lost them because of the coal mines.
Well, on the subject of coal, and you wrote about this earlier this year, Juan Pablo, one of the problems with coal is coal ash, and that is a toxic mix of chemicals that are left over after burning coal. And the state has been pretty much out in front on cleanup of coal ash in most places when it comes to legislation, but a lot of folks don't think it's moving fast enough. So what's going on with that?
Yeah, and this story focused on a community in Waukegan. Waukegan is this kind of suburb just north of Chicago, 40 miles or so. And the issue there was that the Waukegan Generating Station, which had closed in 2022, had left some byproducts. So there was three ponds. Ponds is what they call these things where they put coal ash. So coal ash is stored in these ponds, sometimes called impoundments. Sometimes they're lined, sometimes they're not. And in Waukegan, what they had found was that these coal ash ponds were leaching into the groundwater. Worse yet, they were right near Lake Michigan. And so there were all these concerns about what happens next. I want to say that about 5 years ago, like you said, Illinois passed some pretty comprehensive legislation about how it was going to handle its coal ash pollution. It's not just in Waukegan. It's all over Illinois. Illinois is among the United States, has one of the largest number of impoundments. I think only Indiana is higher. And so these are all over the place. And so what we do with them, how we deal with them is going to be a very important part of all of this clean energy transition, right? And so 5 years ago, we passed this legislation. 2 years later, the IEPA comes out with the regulation of how they're going to tell impoundment owners about how they have to deal with this. So either they have to adapt or shut it down. So then they had all the impoundment owners submit permits. So altogether, I think the IEPA is looking at 44 separate coal ash impoundments permits, and that's for like 25 current or former power plants across the state. I just checked this morning because the IEPA actually has this great website where you can see who submitted what and if there is a permit out yet. There are a couple draft permits out, but to date, there are no finalized permits through this program. So at this point in Illinois, all of our impoundments, our coal ash impoundments, are unpermitted under this latest regulation.
Charlie, this reminds me of just about anything you look back on where something was made or energy was created. There have been problems. It doesn't have to go far from your hometown of Joliet, Charlie. When you look at the Joliet arsenal that used to be there, and you know, they made things like TNT there, and you had byproducts that were left over from that contaminated soil. Cleanup is a real problem, and it's costly and it's time consuming.
Yeah, and in the coal ash situation, Juan Pablo was mentioning that it's all over the state. As a matter of fact, here in Springfield, the City Water, Light, and Power plant had several impoundments, and they no longer use them for the waste ash that's generated. They have a new type of process. So they now use something called a dry ash handling system, and that is not put into these impoundments. But they had these ponds, and they were, oh gosh, right across a dam, and on one side of the dam is Lake Springfield, which provides drinking water for Springfield. On the other side of the dam, across the road, are these ponds of this toxic material. And a couple of years ago, there was a study, an analysis of groundwater, found that the level of arsenic in the groundwater is 14 times the safe level. Boron was 10 times safe level in groundwater monitors from these Dahman power plant ponds. And of course, arsenic is a substance that's known to cause cancer. Boron is one that can affect the stomach, intestines, liver, kidney, and brain. So they're very dangerous. The city is no longer putting the byproducts of the coal burning into these ponds, but the question is, what do we do with them? And the argument is the cheapest way to do it is just put a cover over it. But the problem is, if it's not lined, you put a cover over it, but those materials will still leach out into the groundwater. And as a matter of fact, a couple months ago, the city council in Springfield okayed a study. I think it's going to cost like $150,000 to figure out what can we do to cap these coal ash ponds, either, and the ideal one, environmentalists say, well, don't cap them. What you need to do is actually truck the stuff out of them, drain them, get all this toxic material, take and put it into a safe landfill. And whether or not that will happen, you know, who knows?
Let me save a couple of minutes here, Juan Pablo, for another issue that cropped up. It's been something that's gotten a lot of attention, and that is these pipelines. Oftentimes, there have been pipelines from ethanol plants to take the byproducts of that and also, you know, bury it underground, sequestration. A lot of people don't like that near them, but yet it's also billed as a way to do more cleaner energy production. So the state of Illinois has put a moratorium on these pipelines, I believe, for 2 years while these are studied a little bit more. But does that just set the state back when it comes to trying to meet its goals?
It's a good question, I think, because you're right. The Biden administration itself has pumped billions of dollars into CCS through the Inflation Reduction Act, its premier climate legislation. I mean, even through CEJA, the Climate Equitable Jobs Act, it had a provision calling for a study into CCS technology. So one way or the other, there has been a lot of interest around this kind of emerging technology. Does it set the state back? I don't know. It's hard to say, because if you talk to the advocates, some of the people who are working on the ground to get this moratorium passed, they'd say, hey, there's still a lot we don't know about this technology or on the safety issues around this technology, and we want to make sure that we'll be safe if something happens. So, for example, I want to say 4 years ago in Setarsha, Mississippi, there was a rupture of one of these kind of sites, and that hospitalized something like 40 people. So there are concerns, and rightfully so, about what could happen here. And so does it set the industry back? It's hard to say, I think. I think it's hard to say.
And these are, politically, these just have not been popular in the areas where, and they're running sometimes hundreds and hundreds of miles. I mean, from plants that are located in, you know, two or three states away, and they're going to have a pipeline running all this way to bury it in some other location where, and often it's been in Illinois where this seems like this is the best spot, maybe even in central Illinois. And yet, people don't want that near them. There are fears of these pipelines. And when you're running pipelines that far, yeah, a problem, I guess, is more likely to happen. There's just miles and miles and miles of them.
All those pipelines that have been proposed, none of them have, they've all been blocked so far coming into Illinois.
That's right.
And Illinois, central Illinois, is kind of a prime area for that just because of the geology. And I'm not a geologist, so I understand, but apparently there's a very permeable level of sandstone, and on top of it is some sedimentary rock that serves as a cap. And the idea is you inject the carbon dioxide into the sandstone, and it'll stay there. But again, there's no guarantee that it'll stay there forever, and there's a concern about it leaching into groundwater. As a matter of fact, one of the objections to the law that got passed was it did not ban sequestration under the Mahomet Aquifer. And the Mahomet Aquifer is a huge underground water source that serves something like 15 or 20 counties in east central Illinois. And as a matter of fact, one of the lead opponents, Senator Chapin Rose, who's a Republican from Mahomet, filed legislation to ban carbon sequestration over the Mahomet Aquifer, which he said supplies water for 1 million people in central Illinois. And he noted, this is not some partisan issue, and I'm quoting him here now, quote, clean water is not a partisan issue. This is a common sense issue. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican or independent or otherwise, you want to be able to turn on your water and drink it.
As a recap for folks, and it's been good to talk about some of these issues, but for people that don't follow it as closely but are wondering just, you know, how the state is doing, maybe just give us the overall view that you have as somebody who reports on the environment.
I think when I think about how the clean energy transition is happening in Illinois, like I said, Illinois has a leg up. The nuclear power plants really do give us an advantage in terms of getting there faster. But on the other side, when it comes to filling in the space with solar, with wind, all of that is happening too. I mean, it seems like it's every other month or something that we hear something from Governor Pritzker about new money coming in for more of these projects, whether it's EVs, whether it's charging infrastructure, helping rethinking about the way we do sustainable agriculture, whether it's electrifying buildings, like every single part of our state is changing. And it might seem like imperceptible, but it really is happening kind of all at once. Like just in Chicago, like a couple months ago, I did a story about geothermal, where they're running geothermal through the alleys in a South Side neighborhood. You know, all of it's kind of happening, and it's so interesting to watch.
All right. Well, Charlie, let's go to a note from the field. There are some other things that have happened this week, so I'll give you an opportunity for that.
Illinois Flash Index has continued its recent decline in August. It fell to 102 from its 102.3 level in July, and that's the fourth consecutive month of modest weakening. But and this is something that is pointed out in every one of these reports, any reading above 100 still reflects growth. And that's according to Professor Emeritus Fred Geertz, who compiles this index for the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And he said, quote, "These declines indicate a slowing economy consistent so far with a soft landing, not a recession." And the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability released their latest monthly report, and that shows, and this kind of reflects what the professor was noting with the Flash Index. For the first 2 months of FY25, in other words, July and August, general funds receipts are up $437 million, which is an increase of 6.4%. And it's mainly due to the net personal income tax, which is up $260 million. The bottom line is that we have this 6.4% growth, which is not as good as you'd like it. And one of the concerning things is that the net sales tax was off a fraction. And sales tax, of course, is one of the biggest, after the personal income tax, sales tax is the second biggest revenue source for the state.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Remember, you can find our show where you get your podcasts, also through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. Our panel this week, Charlie Wheeler and Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco, environment reporter with WBEZ and Grist. Don't forget to join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.